You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 154 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. It's 4 weeks since we last sat down, so Chris is back in the studio today. We're returning to the Future of Contracting series, and I am looking ahead at 2024. We're in Q1. What is the rest of 2024 going to look like? Maybe what is 2025 going to look like? And I've linked an article in the show notes, which I was asked to write by the RICS, which is kind of along those lines. It's my forecast for construction costs, both materials and labour in 2024. You're laughing your little head off, aren't you? Chris knows, and maybe you guys all know by now, that I'm a rather sad individual. And the prospect of A, writing an article, and B, researching an article is something that I rather enjoy. So you know that anyway, mate. So when they came up to me and said, would you like to write this? I obviously said, yes, please, and decided to write it. But I'm joined in the studio by Chris Barber. I've introduced him before. Obviously, my business partner, chief visionary officer at C-Link, QS, being both main contract, being subcontract side. How are you, mate?
We're friends as well. You forgot that bit, didn't you?
I said mate, didn't I? Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Sensitive.
I'm good. You know, it's a Friday afternoon, sat with my best pal. Life doesn't get much better.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about construction costs and how much he likes researching. Now, I mean, I can really get into it. When you read this article, guys, you'll see that during the pandemic, I was a bit obsessed with looking at the Lumber Futures Index, which is the index for raw timber materials. I know it all. Read this article, you're going to see how much of a maniac and loser I am. But all jokes aside, talking about the article, I just want to try and summarize it. And we've talked about, on episode 151, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, I highly recommend that you do. I mean, tooting my own horn here, but as a guest, Noble Francis, construction economist, someone who really does have his ear to the ground in terms of where we're going in terms of construction costs and the like, really helped me to frame my article and so on and so forth. So go back and listen to that. And really, where we are, I'll summarize kind of in headlines. So in 2023, the industry saw a reduction in output generally. It was about 6%. Private housing, so the house builders and small developers, private housing, which is the biggest part of the pie, it's the biggest sector, 40 billion, dropped by 20%. Mortgages, interest rates, all the things around that. That obviously impacted labour demand. There was less demand for labour because we were doing 20% less in private housing. And inflation came down slowly but surely. And what we're expecting this year in 2024 is little to no growth, much more of the same, which in terms of materials is not necessarily an issue. Materials are kind of stagnated. They spiked up. We had hyperinflation, obviously, during the post-pandemic years, 21, 22, really, really bad. 2023, you got much more of a plateau, and we have now kind of stopped at a level. We're much higher than we were during the pandemic, or before the pandemic, sorry. So we are a lot higher, but I'm guessing that everyone, most subcontractors, most contractors now have got that extra cost kind of bought in. If they're on a fixed price tender, that's all included. So materials is less of the concern as I see it, honestly. And the big concern that I see is with regards to labor. And I think we've got a big skill shortage, we've got a big labor shortage. And this is all in the context of 20% output reduction, right? So we're, as an industry, doing 20% less house building with a labor shortage. So my instinct tells me that we are in a situation where we are by no means fully understanding how bad that labor shortage is just yet. And my takeaway, and we've talked about this a lot as well, Chris, you're going to be smirking, is that there has to be a macro industry strategy in regards to labor. But if you're a main contractor, subcontractor, whoever you are, if you're building
as part of your business, you need to be thinking about what your strategy is before. So obviously, you're an avid listener to Own the Build, Chris. You're almost as sad as I am. And you've read the article that I penned. What are your initial reactions like? What are your thoughts?
I think I'd like Noble Francis as well. He's my second favourite economist after Tim Harford, just to let you know. And then maybe yourself, if you're going to put yourself in that group now, you've written that article. But the two main things being labour and material prices, it speaks for itself, doesn't it? I think the labour one, like you mentioned, is the pressing concern, and what can we do to assist the impact that it's going to have. And that's not the political party Labour, by the way, the Labour shortage, just to clarify.
just on that, like zooming out then, and this is a big question and you may feel like it's a difficult one to answer. It probably is. If like as an industry, we have a labour shortage, there's lots of people trying to do things about it. And interestingly enough, again, speaking to a guest who is about to come on the show, who is really passionate about changing the perception of construction. She told me actually that recently she went back to her school. She's a project manager. She went back to her school to kind of do like a careers day. And it's a girls' grammar school. So not the typical, construction is not the typical route. And she said that actually the kids were quite receptive to her. She's young, 20-something project manager. Really, she loves construction, really enjoying it. And the kids were really receptive, but actually it was the parents who were like, no, I wouldn't see my daughter going into construction or doing anything like that, which I found quite interesting. And I'm about to ask you, what should we do as an industry to change things? But that alone kind of shocked me. Right? I don't know, what do you make of that?
They're not boomers, are they? Quite.
No, they're not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception, isn't there, in the industry that it's a bit of a dirty industry. And the more females we can get into the industry and prove it wrong, the better is how I look at it.
Yeah.
Because it's been very, toxic masculinities through in the veins in the old construction world, and it's still there. But I was sat in front of the RICS panel who were reaccrediting our old university. And I asked them a question about, what are they doing to try and attract more quantity surveyors to the industry? I won't tell you how the conversations went, but how I feel about it, it should be, all the trade associations should be coordinating a campaign out there with the universities and with the bigger contractors to attract new talent and make the industry look sexy and make it look like not the dirty industry that these parents had, this dirty...
Perception.
Where
are you going with this?
Yeah, so
these dirty parents.
The dirty perception that they had, they need to dispel that myth, but it needs to be a coordinated message from the very top, which I see is the trade associations, and working with each university and all these big main contractors who've got a big stake in it, in this pie, yeah. Big slice of the pie. So the message is consistent and they work together as a team to get it out there and attract as much talent as possible. And that's how I see it working.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that some of the trade associations or industry organizations would be listening to this and saying, yeah, that's, we're doing that. We are doing that. And I think that there is a change. There is a shift, but as ever in construction, it's so slow and stodgy. And this series is about the future of contracting, right? And that's great on a macro level. And I guess when I was writing this piece, I was looking at it on a macro level, but also thinking what it would be like if I was a commercial director, commercial manager at an organization, and I was reading the numbers and the research, and I was thinking, okay, so maybe materials I've got priced in, but labor I haven't. Or labor maybe doesn't feel like an issue now because output is low and so supply and demand. If you were a commercial director at a main contractor, what would you be doing if you read that there is a labor shortage and we haven't really felt the full pain?
I think go back to episode 142, I think was it, where we're talking about tender strategy and supply chain strategy. I think it all starts with being the supply chain strategy. Now the two things to inhibit the growth of a subcontractor is the ability to have cash flow and project accurately cash flow projections and have the cash in the bank, and two is pipeline certainty. So if you could give your supply chain the pipeline certainty, saying, look, we've got approximately 10 projects coming in, approximately, it doesn't have to be rock solid numbers.
Yeah.
There's three preferred contractors, dry lining contractors, for example, in this organization. You're going to at least win one or two this year. Mm. I want you to be at the heart and soul of that, really buying them into the process. Now, they're going to immediately think, I can start investing in my company, whether that be technology, more apprentices, etc. You're giving them the certainty that they're going to win £500,000, £1 million worth of work, for example.
Yeah.
You empower your supply chain to grow their business. And that's where I would start it from.
But I don't want to tell them that they're going to win £500,000 worth of work because I want to do a competitive tender.
Yeah. But like I said, there's three people. You tell them that they're going to be competitively tendering against each other. And because of, from a risk perspective, you know, you're not going to choose one for all 10 projects because they're going to be overexposed and they won't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. So it's about buying them into the process of, you're going to be up against other people. They're our preferred. Our three preferred contractors. And you still create that competitive tension between on that package, but you're also giving them the certainty that they're going to win something.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? And that, I think, is at the heart of where the reservation often comes from big contractors or small contractors, right? Is that you do think, I can't say to subby 1, 2, and 3, I've got three jobs, you're all going to get one. But I guess the question is, and you can't do that because it's a bit of a, you know, we're all trying to scrap around for a small amount of margin. But are you saying that irrespective of that competitive tendering process, I should be saying to them, all three of you, I've got three jobs, all three of you are going to get one because of the fact that there is a skill shortage and because of the fact that I now need to think medium and long term through 24 and 25.
So we're forecasted to what, lose 6,000 contractors this year. I think August was about 4,200 we've lost. So we're on track, right? Do you want your subby to potentially go bust halfway through your project because hasn't got the labour? He's underperformed on another project because he hasn't got the labour to do it. He's now getting screwed for money and he can't, you know, that's going to impact your project. You've got to protect your supply chain, and that's how you do it. If you keep it them at arm's length and they're against 10 other contractors, you're not giving them any confidence or surety that they're going to win something, then you're going to be scrapping around when it comes to the end of your project because there's a likelihood that your subcontractor may not be operating to the full capacity that they could be.
And having been a subby yourself, how would you want, because I have been a subby and I would think, yeah. You're going to give me one of those three jobs. Are you? Because there's this state of mistrust. And also, if you're a subby and there is a known shortage of skill and labour, in some respects, to you, that represents an opportunity, right? Because you would think, right, okay, supply and demand, there's less specialists like me, so I'm going to be in higher demand and therefore my prices are going to go up. So this is the difficult push and pull that you always have between that main contract and subcontract relationship. If you're like, how, as a main contractor, this is, I think the heart of it is 2024, there's a skill shortage, there's a labor shortage, you're not really feeling it right now. By 2025 and beyond, you definitely will be, unless there's some major shift. And if you're a subby, it's not your problem. It's kind of what is, it's your advantage, right? So how, as a main contractor, would you go about changing, like ensuring that the subcontractor is on your team?
Treating them right.
That simple.
Well, you know, it goes back to that early, you know, engagement, bringing them in like a partner, not giving them 100%. Every job's yours because you've got to protect your own commercial interests. You know, that is a thing. But if you're buying them in early, you know how they operate, you're giving them, you can have that open dialogue with them as well. How are they, you know, how are they performing? Are they, you know, are they a bit squeezed on other projects? You know, is it impacting them? Just having that open, really good rapport with them and dialogue will transition then that through into the performance of the project that they're on throughout the 2024. you know, paying them on time, doing the small things right, you know, maybe giving them material on site payments, you know, helping them out with the cash flow and those kind of methods, you know, really kind of just assisting each other. They'll help you out of a hole if you've helped them out of a hole. And it's just like a friendship. That's how you should look at it in some ways. It has got commercial interests, but if you're working together as a team rather than in isolation on project to project, hand by mouth kind of situation, then you're going to be able to grow your own business through your supply chain.
Yeah, and it's that strategic take a step back view, isn't it? And we've talked about taking a step back and thinking about the long term. We've talked about whether or not main contractors have always got the right systems in place. If they had different systems in place, they could take that more strategic long-term view, look at all the different packages that their contractors are procuring. And I think in many ways, it's that systemized approach and the mentality that has to change. We will come back right after this break and talk more on this topic, Christopher. Right now, there are between 5 and 10,000 QS vacancies in the UK. Loads of main contractors that we speak to are struggling to recruit and find QSs, and also struggling to recruit and find high quality subcontractors given the skills shortage. Having worked as a QS for many years, I've seen firsthand the challenges of managing subcontract procurement, and I understand that many projects will fail by getting procurement wrong. This is why we built C-Link. With C-Link, you will build resilience. You'll centralize your supply chain data, automate procurement, and access digital contracts to present yourself as a world-class contractor. To find out more, you can now go to the show notes and you will see that we have included a video and a demo link so that you can meet either me or meet the team and understand better what we do. I look forward to speaking to you all. Thank you very much. I feel, Chris, that we have talked a lot now about like how you should culturally shift the supply chain in terms of how you manage them as a main contractor. And I think people listening understand our views on that and hopefully agree and, you know, shifting mentalities. We were just talking during the break there about that is kind of like positioning, right? Like, how are you positioning yourself to your subcontractors and your supply chain to be a company that they want to work with in 2024, 2025, 2026. Now, you were talking about payments. You were talking about the famous time, cost, and quality triangle. Just talk about time, cost, and quality in the context of like procurement methods and in the context of how maybe as a wider industry, we should be going back as main contractors to our clients and just saying no.
Yeah, I think I've talked about this before quite a few times with you and other people about we're stuck in this where C is at the top of the triangle and it's
cost.
Yeah, cost is at the top of the triangle and it is at the detriment to the whole industry as a whole. Everyone's got this focus, even on projects where Q&T are at the top, let's just say, people are still think the subliminally C is still there for a lot of QSs and a lot of ways businesses operate. Because I'd say 95% of projects are all C-oriented, really.
Cost-oriented.
Cost-oriented. Yeah, sorry, yeah, just to add to that. Sorry, Paul. But how I see it is if everyone could move towards quality and time and position their business as a main contracting business, like cost control is obviously important. We're not going to be overly frivolous.
But it's not a race to the bottom.
But it shouldn't be a race to the bottom. But we're going to position our business as we provide a high quality service, you get a high quality product, and our focus is on delivering on time.
And that is, when you say position yourself, you're talking about with clients.
Yeah.
So what, you turn away low quality, low cost kind of work and say, we just obstinately refuse to be involved in that market anymore. We don't want to do it. That's the construction industry of the 20th century. We want to now work in the 21st century. I've realized we're 20 years into it, but we're a quarter of the way through. But is that, like, it's easy to say that, Chris, right? And I talked with Mike Wharton about this, and we were talking in the context of subbies, right? Where Mike was saying, you know, subbies, the problem can often be with the industry that there's a project and you can say, no, I don't want to agree to those terms and conditions. I don't want to agree to that price. But someone will always come along, whether you're a main contractor or a specialist, and take it. And, you know, in that conversation we were talking about, the main contractor saying to Mike, other specialists, subcontractors will agree to these terms and conditions, so why won't you? And he said, well, we just won't. It's like principle, we won't do it. And they said, well, okay, fine. Someone else would. And so we were talking in the same, like, just say no, just say no. If all specialists, all subbies said no in that instant, the entire industry would change. But he was saying, that's not what happens, though, is it? Because if it, someone else will come along and take it. And the reason why I'm reflecting on that is it's all good and well saying that main contractors need to position themselves in a way that says, look, for far too long, we've accepted far too little. Our margins haven't been what they should be for all the risks that we take on, for all the management that we do. We need to give more to our subbies, and there's a skill shortage that we are ramping up for and protecting against, and it's for the good of the industry. No, I am not going to accept your nonsense anymore. I'm not going to accept, Mr. Client, 2% margin. All good and well. I say that as a main contractor. You waddling into mid-tender review number two right after me, you say yes because you need that job. So I hear what you're saying, but like, how do we actually get out of this vicious cycle that we're in?
I think it is a balance, and it is a almost a coordinated as a collective. We need to shift to T&Q, time and quality.
T&Q, bloody hell.
To be able to get out of it collectively because of the labour shortage, because of the material cost price increases. We cannot be focused on projects that are cost oriented from the start, right at the top of the triangle, because the market conditions don't allow for it. And we're just going to see higher and higher insolvencies. So how I would see it is, as a main contractor, we're really good on the Q, quality. We're really good on quality. So our USP is going to be all about delivering, as a main contractor, delivering quality projects. And this is how we do it. We've got this tech stack that we have as a business. We've got this really engaged supply chain who perform high quality work. We've got access to these artisan tradesmen, et cetera. Like, really building up your USP as a main contractor.
Yeah.
And then you could get another contractor who's like, really, I'm really good at time. I've got all these offsite prefabricated supply chain contacts, etc., who I use for my projects, and we specialize in this niche, and this is what we deliver. And I feel like there's a lot of main contractors out there that will take on pretty much any kind of project.
Yeah.
And that is
focused on cost.
And that is
because that's what the industry's been.
Yeah, and it is all cost related, and they're probably stretched too thin, and they don't really have a USP. There is so much, there's an angle out there for a lot of main contractors to be either really focused on the queue, the quality and the time. And they're all going to have their own little ways of how they administer their projects internally that will make the client go, wow, I need to go for the time. I need to go for the quality. Because I realize if I go for C, I might have a contractor that goes bust in halfway through the project. I might also have a lift that doesn't work after 6 months because I've chosen the cheapest lift, and all these things that come with the sit with cost. Correcting myself halfway through is you need to make it clear and the messaging really clear to clients.
So what you're actually arguing for here is, we talked in the first half about manage your supply chain, have a different culture around that, but what you're actually saying is there is a labor shortage. It's coming down the track, 2024, 2025. Everyone's going to be struggling. So actually, you almost turn defense into attack, right? What you're actually saying is, let's get the defense sorted with our supply chain, right? But let's actually go out on the attack as a company and market ourselves, position ourselves as a main contractor who, it's quite interesting how you frame that, as either really high quality focused or time focused, as opposed to being exclusively cost focused, which I think all of us have been. So I actually think that's a really interesting way to think about how you can strategically look ahead as a main contracting business to 25, 26, and actually just say, we are going to be different. We are going to market ourselves as different. If you are not interested in working with us for time or for quality, that's fine. There will be people who are interested with us. And maybe that, you know, as opposed to the someone else is going to take that job eventually. Maybe if everyone was actually thinking about positioning and marketing and so on in that vein, slowly but surely there would be a change in how we as an industry have a have margin, because main contract margins are absurdly low considering what they do. We also talked in the break there about your experience working for a high-end contractor. And just want to link what you were saying there about, you know, if a main contractor says, you know, what I want to do in terms of my strategy is be perceived as high quality, or I want to be, you know, MMC, it's going to be about time. And then you're positioned in that way. What was it like working on projects where quality was front and center?
Stressful. No, you had to get the procurement right. And that's, you know, you're leaning on your supply chain, that, you know, these artisan trades. Once you've got a contract and it's set out from the start, it's £5 million, you're working on this house, they've bought the quality at this stage, so you've got to deliver on it. And your focus is around about, get, you know, you're trying to drive additional value for your business, don't get me wrong, but you can't just get anybody in to do a real key feat, a bit of work that is that, like, it's a finished item, a facing item that the client's going to see. You know that needs to be high quality. So your focus is on the queue. So you're, when you're doing your due diligence, you will be looking at, you know, existing work, getting them to do mock-ups, getting them to do samples, etc., just so you're really controlling that quality.
And when you're at tender stage, I'm not sure how involved you were personally at tender stage, obviously estimator to QS handoff, but I'm just trying to picture a world where all main contractors were focused on quality, time and cost in equal measure, right? As we were just assessing, and there'll be main contractors listening saying, we obviously are, and I'm not, that's not what we're agitating for here. What we're agitating for is, let's get away from low margins, right? And maybe a way to do that is to position yourself for quality and time. Company you worked with before completely positioned themselves on quality. It was ridiculous projects that you were doing. How was the perception different at tender stage?
So, yeah, at tender stage, we did also get at the time things that maybe weren't suitable, that were of, like, where cost was, it was, you know, not the right project. You know, you're not having these marble finishes, etc., in there, building double-story basements. The perception at tender stage, you know, you try and, because we did do some tendering, and, you know, you take your client, prospective client, and you'll go and show them one of your projects, because they're really interested in your marble finishes, you know, how the joinery details, shadow box details, all these things that, like, your craftsman will be doing in your supply chain. They'll be looking at that and thinking, wow, these guys deliver a really good high quality scheme. I want to work with them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, talking about defense and attack here, right? I like football, but we're talking about defense and attack. So defense we've covered with the supply chain. Attack is, like, how we're going to position ourselves and change things. Going back to supply chain. Now, you're a subcontractor. You're looking at the market right now and you're thinking, okay, there's going to be a shortage in my trade. Happy days, right? That might mean that I'm going to be able to put my rates up, blah, blah, blah. But you were also probably thinking, who do I want to work with? And again, this is what it goes back to with, you know, supply chain management with main contractors. This is what we're advocating for. But you could have it where you are a main contractor who curates your supply chain, cares about your supply chain, puts your arm around the supply chain, and you're a main contractor that is focused on quality, in your example, right? And subcontractor is seen that they're actually a company that could be really interesting for me to partner with. They're someone who, look at the projects that they're working on, it's high quality. Yes, they're someone that I want to align myself with in the long term. So that's 24, 25, 26. So you're defending against that as a main contractor. Is there anything else? You're a little bit, this is an understatement, of an advocate for fair payment practice and technology. Is there a third string to the bow? We've covered supply chain, we've covered positioning. Is there a third string to the bow that you think a main contractor could strategically add to make themselves stand out to that subby who thinks, I can pick and choose as I wish?
Payment terms and...
No.
Payment terms and payment mechanisms, I think, and how they approach the supply chain when it comes to payment. I kind of briefly touched on it a moment ago when I said, if they've got a lot of subcontractors, they're going to have to buy a lot of materials on credit, etc. If you have an open collaboration with the subcontractor and say to them, look, I know you're going to have to spend X hundred thousand on your dry line and materials, bring them in on day one, not all of them because you don't have room, but like bring X amount in and we'll agree a material on site payment plan with you just to help with your cash flow. You know, there's little risk there for the main contractor because the material's on site. You're only paying for the material element and you've agreed that up front. And, you know, the PQS will have to value the materials on site as well. So it's little risk and you're really helping out the subcontractor. You know what? If you treat subcontractors well, it'll spread like wildfire.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they'll talk down the pub, so-and-so doesn't pay. Oh, but these guys, yeah, really good.
That
really
is so true, isn't it? That is so true.
Yeah.
It was even, you know, on company I worked at, even on a QS level. So we would be a huge company and I would be working on one project and somebody I'd be working with would be like, why is it that I always get paid on time when I'm on your project, but when I'm on QSX's project, it doesn't happen? And that was maybe because that specific QS didn't care so much, didn't see the value so much in the transaction of money immediately to the subby and what that means. But that's exactly the same on a company level, right? That main contractor is a slow pair, or this one is an amazing pair, which takes me back again. I'm going to take it back to that RICS piece that I've written because I want everyone to go and read it. No, but there is a genuine, you hear all these buzzwords, don't you? And you think, skill shortage, blah, 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 blah. Is it ever going to affect me? The fact is, I wholeheartedly believe that the skill shortage is soon to hit and it's soon to be felt. And the reason you're not feeling it right now is because output is down, right? So if that is going to happen, what do you do about it? And how often do we talk, or I talk to main contractors even, and say, I've been a subby, and what I often feel like is that when main contractors send tenders, they don't realise that the subby has options. That we get to the office Friday afternoon and we say, right, which ones are we going to price next week? And we've got five tender packs. Four of them don't have the information and I'm going to price the fifth. And, you know, just flipping your mentality and thinking about how your supply chain feels. We've talked about that loads and main contractors, often the penny drops when I speak to people about just that simple thought. But the fact is that if you're a specialist right now and you're looking at the skills shortage, you are going to be thinking, this is an opportunity for me. It's probably going to be a good few years, right? And we've even heard main contractors say, specialists have had their time. We're getting discounts. I won't go into that, right? You know what we're talking about. So if you are a main contractor now, picturing the future, put yourselves in the shoes of the specialist. And the specialist is thinking, I've got options here. I am in high demand and I'm probably going to get into even higher demand. So I'm going to pick and choose the right main contractor to work with, right? And they are going to be the main contractors that do what, Chris? Pay on time, talk to you. The main contractors who also have positioned themselves, as we've talked about, as, you know, we're not going to be a race to the bottom. We're not going to take on those jobs that are 2% or whatever. We're going to go on the jobs that are different. And that, I think, in itself is just the thing to take away, is what is in the mind of the subby.
Yeah, and I think as well, there could be a push for, you know, project bank accounts that, you know, I'm a big advocate of.
You've mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah, just once or twice, you know, every other day. But if they're not adopted on private work, which is majority of the work, three quarters basically of the output, if you can make it, normalize it, that project bank accounts can be on just this private work to give everybody a bit of comfort.
Yeah.
You know, the client, really market into the client saying, look, you should go with a project bank account because it gives you certainty that I'm paying my supply chain on time. It's only going to benefit your project going forward. We should have one.
Yeah.
And in that positioning yourself, say either the Q or the CMT, the time or the quality, with the project bank account, that's what I really want. Then your supply chain will say, well, I'm working with this main contractor because I fit in with what they do. They're all about quality work and they have project bank accounts. I want to work with that main contractor. And it only makes it more and more robust.
Yeah, and it's not rocket science, is it? And hopefully, you know, concluding and wrapping up this episode, I would hope that there are conversations that now start to happen in main contract boardrooms, SME, big companies, whoever, where this is actually front and center. And it's something you've got to think about right now in the early months of 2024, because 2025, 2026 is going to happen. Hopefully this conversation has helped. Chris, as ever, you've been incredibly insightful, despite the QCT thing, but we got over it. Thanks for coming on the show, mate.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And guys, as always, I will see or speak to you next week. Thank you very much.